This is episode 1 Delta of Free As in Freedom for Tuesday, November 29th, 2011. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free As in Freedom.
And we've forgotten how difficult it is to be in two different locations when we record. This is why we started always trying to record in the same location with the same microphone.
Yeah, I think Dan and Fab actually always record separately, don't they?
Yeah, they do, but they have better equipment than we do.
Yeah. It's definitely been an ordeal, so hopefully Dan will perform his magic and this will be okay.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, we went through an ordeal so that you could have a good microphone on your end, and I have our usual microphone with me on my end. Our back channel does not sound so great, but I think everyone will hear us okay. I wonder if your laptop is plugged in, though, because I hear an interesting audio buzz on your side. But now,
my laptop is plugged in. Because yeah. It's the only way that I can record because my laptop battery has so been thoroughly fried.
Yeah, I heard a strange background noise for a while there, but then it went away. So I don't know what that was.
Again, if it sounds okay, it's due to the magic of Dan Lynch.
Okay.
At halfbakemedia.com.
So we actually have one leftover interview it's not leftover, but it was one remaining interview that we hadn't put onto the show yet. That we were able to, you were able to record at UDS. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's actually it's still not so old. It's just a couple of weeks old. But I had the pleasure of doing an interview at UDS. It was great. This is we did one other with Adam Dingle from Yorba, and this was the other that I had done at UDS.
So do you want to just play the interview and folks can hear it, or is that what we should do next, or is there anything interesting? Do we need any setup for this clip, Karen?
I don't know. Did you listen to it? I think
I did,
right.
Yeah.
Was there anything you think that you would have been improved had you known in advance?
No, I just was doing that thing they do on shows where on interview shows. I say, do we need any setups for the clip that you brought today?
Oh right. Not that I can think of.
So this is an interview with Stefano Zaccaroli. Is I say his name right?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Username is Zach Z A C K for our non-US listeners.
That's right. Not Z A C H, which some people seem to think is the case.
Well,
they corrected me.
Yes, it's true. It's true. And there's somebody on Identica with that username who's also involved in free software. And so it can get confusing. So yeah, Z-A-C-K is the right, Z-A-C-K. And this is an interview about a lot of different topics. You discuss Debian and lots of other different types of free software issues. So let's play that for everybody, and then we'll talk about the show afterwards, or the interview afterwards.
Great. So I am here at UDS with Zach, with Stefano, who is the lead maintainer of Debian. Essentially, what is the actual title?
So the actual title is Debian Project Leader. DPL is the acronym. So hi, everybody.
And I don't know, just to get started, can you maybe tell us how you got involved in free software to begin with?
So as many people, I encountered a sort of a prophet in my university curriculum. So it was second year, I was studying computer science, operating systems, and the professor was a huge fan of free software and taught us how cool it was to actually work as a student on something you can study, you can do whatever you want to with it. So that's why I got my first, exposition to free software.
What was your first free software contribution? Do you remember?
Oh my! I really don't remember. It's probably a bug repo to Debian because the lab was using Debian everywhere. But no, I really don't remember that.
That's funny. I've never asked that question before, and I don't know that it's really, I think it's a hard one to answer. So that's how you got involved in Debian. And, you know, how did you get sort of more involved and get towards the position that you have today?
So actually, back then, as a user, I started with, I think, the Red Hat. So a lot of us started with buying the Red Hat book, which came with a CD to install it on your computer. Then I think I flirted a bit with Minix. So I installed Minix on my computer. And then actually, I started using Debian a bit later, so was still university, third or fourth year. And I started working on a research group for what has then become my master thesis. And we were using OCaml as a programming language, and we were using the Debian machine of the lab. And the libraries we were needing were not available in Debian. So I started doing the packaging. I started figuring out, okay, how can I do that? I started doing the packaging, offering that to Debian. And at some point, someone who was in Debian told me, okay, why don't you become a Debian developer and do you work officially in the distribution? And then all followed up from there.
So what's it like being DPL? Is it fun?
So I guess it depends which kind of geek you are. So there are not many geek tasks in the sense of hacking. So essentially I put on hold my hacking activities when I started doing that. And that was a really wise choice because you cannot do everything. But it is fun. So it is fun at the point that you realize that you are helping other people in Debian having fun. So if you feel this sense of enabling other to have fun, then it's not fun, but it's really rewarding. That, yes. I didn't expect it to be that much rewarding, actually.
Would you do it again? I'm sorry, I totally put you on the spot. It popped into my mind, and so I figured I'd ask.
You mean if I go back, would I do it again? Yes.
I mean in future.
Oh no, that's not putting me on the spot. Everybody asks that.
Oh, okay.
So and the answer is I don't think so. I mean, I've been very happy to doing that. It's been very rewarding. I've been doing that for a couple of years. I think I've done a lot, and it's time to move on.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, it just seems to take up a lot of time. I mean, I know it. There are a lot of positions, I think, in the free software world, and not nonprofits generally, I think, and things that you care about, where there are positions that you can take that are, you know, they have titles, so they're exciting in that regard, and they're, you know, you get a chance to really do a lot for something that you care for, but at the same time, it takes up so much time, and a lot of that is things that you might not necessarily want to do otherwise. So you talked about putting your hacking on hold. And that's the kind of thing I think people don't really think about, how much you have to give in order to do a position like that. I think this is why I've generally tried to avoid serving on boards of directors and things like that. I feel like if I'm going to be volunteering for something, I'd rather just do whatever work it is that I want to do instead of getting a title and then being, you know, sucked into having to do the whole range of things. Is that sort of how you found it?
So yes, partly yes, but I mean, part of the problem in Debian is that there is not much documentation about what the role of the DPL is about. I think many people step in to become a DPL because they care about being the representative of the Debian project. They want to change things, but actually a lot of the thing you end up doing is day-to-day activity, which is fundamental to keep the project alive and to avoid having bottlenecks. Because essentially everything is Debian, which is not everything, but a lot of management tasks, which people don't even know exist, falls on the shoulder of the DPL. So you end up doing all this kind of stuff. And when you step in to do that, you are not really aware of what you're going to do. So this is something we need to fix in some way to be, you know, I think the people that nominate themselves should be more aware of what they are stepping in for. So that's part of the difficulty here.
When is the term over?
It's in April, so we have a 1 year term, and it's synchronized on, I think, mid-April, like 15 or 16 of April, something like that.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't realized that it was just a one-year term. I guess some people in the past have done multiple years in a row.
So the 2 years in a row is pretty common if you look at the common history. So that's pretty standard, because 1 year is quite short, because you have to, I mean, you have to learn the job with all the quotes needed. You have to get to know people, because it's in good part it's a political role, so you have a lot of interaction with other people, like, I mean, GNOME, other distribution, I mean, and you need to start having other people know you. So that takes some sort of startup time, and you are really effective in what you're doing only after, I would say, 3 or 4 months. So the first year goes away pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think a lot of projects have 1 year terms for things, like the GNOME board and other board positions are reelected every year, but that's tough, because by the time you figure out what you're doing, it's time to step down or get reelected or something like that. So what are some of the things that you're happiest about over the course of the, I guess, since April? It's not that long, but
Okay, so, well, I've been doing that for, actually, this is my second term, so I've been doing that for 1.5 years.
Oh, okay. I think I knew that, which is why I was so surprised.
So, yeah, I've been doing that for a bit now. Right. And so one of the things I'm most happy with is the sort of relationship with other distributions which are based on Debian, like Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to figure out how we can work together while being making both distros happy about their relation with the other. Another very, very important thing I've been happy about is opening up membership in Debian to any kind of contribution. So that's a part which was sort of true, but not really advertised as such. So it was not clear whether doing something else than packaging was enough to become a member of the Debian project. And we have clarified that it is.
That's great, because there's so many people who spend a lot of time on things other than code.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I'm quite happy with the fact that I've been able to communicate a lot with developers about what I've been doing. So everyone, every month, and also with daily logs and all this kind of stuff, which it's some sort of heritage to know what the DPL is about. So that's something I'm very happy as well.
Yeah, that's really great. So what's it like for you here at UDS? How has that sort of, you know, you said that one of the things that you're happiest with is working with, working with others, including Ubuntu. And I think you also said you were here at UDS last year. So how has that been sort of being at UDS and last year as opposed to this year?
Okay, so I've been to, I think this is my third UDS. The first one has been like 1.5 years, shortly after I got elected as DPL. And back then, the relationship among Debian and Ubuntu were still a kind of a touchy topic. I mean, the fact that I was attending UDS made the news, and that's not exactly a good sign.
I don't know anything about that.
Okay, yes, exactly. I think, right. So back then, I wanted to start a dialogue. So presenting to the Ubuntu and people and also to Canonical employees why there was some tension and learning what were their problem in dealing with Debian. So and from there we worked a lot in Debian to generalize opening up our approach to derivatives. So not only Ubuntu, but we have learned a lot in the specific case of Debian and Ubuntu. So we try to opening up and creating a lot of initiatives to be more open to derivatives. So we have a front desk where derivatives can come to us and saying, oh, I've been trying to push my changes to Debian, but I failed for this and that reason. We are doing a census of all the derivatives out there, which is very interesting also for quality assurance. I mean, we have been discovering a lot of distro based on Debian, which were not distributing source packages. I think in very good faith, because they thought, I mean, the packages are in Debian, we don't need to distribute them ourselves, but that's not exactly true. So, I mean, all this kind of stuff is very useful work, and it started from our experience with dealing with Ubuntu.
So that's actually kind of like, you know, enforcement work. Has that been all friendly?
So we are not really doing enforcement. What you're doing is just, first of all, contacting them and telling them, okay, we think you're doing something wrong for a whole lot of packages in your archive. First, in private, because so we didn't want to, you know, make the buzz that we are annoyed by that, because we are not. We just want them to do the right thing. And then with a lot of those people, it worked very well. With others, we had to be a bit more vocal. I mean, I had to dent something to a specific guy. Hey, I think you're not doing the right thing. And that in the end, it's working pretty well.
That's great. I think that actually is similar to most of the enforcement efforts that are done elsewhere too. Or, you know, and I know you were hesitant to call it enforcement work, because I think you're sort of saying we make friendly contact and people fix what they're doing. So it's not really enforcement, because when you say enforcement, it sounds like you're going to be suing someone. But I know that the organizations that have been doing enforcement, you know, the first approach is to contact people in a friendly way. But because you're Debian also, that gives you a little bit more more weight.
No, that's true. So we have also been thinking about doing some, press release with a little bit of naming and shaming, just to explain we want our derivatives to do the right thing. But I haven't called it enforcement also because for a lot of work, we are not the copyright owners. So I don't think we could really do that.
Right.
So, but yeah, so that's a useful contribution as well. So explaining how you should do things to be in good terms with licenses and with software in general.
Have you brought any of those people closer to the Debian community through that process? Has there been really, you know, in addition to getting them to do the right thing, have there been any positive relationships that have come out of that?
Yes, quite a lot. Actually, one of the things I'm most happy, and actually one of the reasons why I first approached the Ubuntu community back then, that a lot of people who starts contributing in derivatives, well, Ubuntu is a big example, of course, but there are others, then realize that they can contribute their work to way more user if their work is also in Debian. So a lot of those people started getting involved in Debian, either as Debian maintainers, which is a technical role in which you can care only about a specific number of packages, but other has done the full step of becoming member of the Debian project. So that's working very well. And I think that, you know, to fix a relationship with among communities, having a huge intersection of the two communities is very, very useful. So yeah, that is part of what we've been doing and is working very well.
So do you have any words of comment about maybe about Debian and GNOME? And GNOME, I'm just, because I'm curious and I'm the one who gets to do the interview.
sure, no problem. So GNOME has been the default desktop on Debian for a long time now. Debian is about choice, so it's not our only desktop. We have several different desktops, but you have a default to choose, and GNOME has always been that for quite a long time for us. And so our policies that we try to, I mean, we're a distribution, right? And I think the role of a distribution is distributing free software. I don't think we are making a specific product. We are just taking software developed by others, being sure that it works well, that there is a good synergy among the software, and reviewing critically the releases of our own upstream. So not all the releases of our own upstream have the same quality. So we pick specific version and say, okay, this version is good enough for us to support it for 2 years or 5 years or whatever. So this is what I think it's the role of a distribution. I don't think the role of a distribution is developing software. So there might be intersections, of course. You might have community which mixes a bit, and you have some distro-specific software you need to develop, like an installer, for instance. But beside that, we try to represent the work of upstream as faithfully as possible and just to bring it to our users. So in that sense, I'm happy with the relationship with GNOME, but I mean, it's what we're trying to do with all our upstream, not just GNOME.
So what are you using?
Myself, so I'm using GNOME 3, but I'm using the fallback mode because I want a tiling window manager, and the tiling features that are in GNOME 3 are not yet up to what I will need. So I'm using GNOME 3 in fallback mode with Awesome as a window manager.
So, you know, I think with what all that happened with Debian, and it's funny, we were laughing before because it is news that I'm at UDS this time. I think a lot of people have noticed and commented, right. And it's great, and it's part of why I'm here. But do you have any sort of, I guess, words of advice for GNOME?
You mean in the specific case of the relationship with Ubuntu, or in, okay?
Yeah, well, and in general.
Okay, so in my case, I think the buzz was actually not really useful in getting the relationship straight. And I mean, we are not entirely happy at the moment either, not on Debian side and not even on the Ubuntu side. So what I think made things improve a lot is being frank about the issues and go to the other and say, okay, these are our issues. This is our point of view. This is how we see it. This is what we are asking. So what's your point of view? Which kind of problem are you seeing coming from us? So an example from my experience is that when I first attended UDS like 1.5 years ago, a lot of people in Ubuntu and also in Canonical were not expecting that Debian was welcoming their contribution. So the reason why there was many people were upset back then is that there was a huge delta among Ubuntu and Debian, and that delta was not being pushed back to Debian. And they were believing that we didn't want that to happen, while in fact it was the reason of the unhappiness in the first place. So suggestion, clarity. Be come here as you did and explain what's not good for you and ask what's not good for them.
So what do you think the biggest challenges are for Debian going forward?
Mm-hmm. So the fact, I think it's more than specific of Debian, it's that in general, the distro market is really shrinking. So I think the usage of free software on desktop machine is decreasing. More and more people are moving apps on this so-called cloud, which have all the software freedom problem we know. But even if those problems didn't exist, computation is moving away from our own PC. So there is a role for distribution there, but I think that numerically is decreasing, and this is challenging in general the notion of distribution. So that's a big challenge for me.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly a big challenge. You know, I think there's all this talk about what, you know, how it, really like high level conversations that we have to have right now about, you know, what is it, you know, what is a computer? How do we use it? How is it in our lives? Where do we think things will be going? And, you know, how does a desktop or a distribution fit into that? You know, do you have any thoughts about that? Sort of that high level, how do we compute? And
so, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I don't see where it is going. I know we all see the trends, but the role of free software and all that is not clear. I mean, the defenses we've been using to protect software freedom are starting to show their weakness. So, for instance, GPL is not enough to defend ourselves from software which are not run on our, which are not distributed to us. So we have some countermeasures like AGPL, but I think they arrived a bit late, and it's not clear how they will catch up. And also, I'm scared by stuff like a big corporation like Google being able to re-implement a whole software stack to be immune from copyleft. So these are challenges for free software in general, and Debian is deeply grounded into free software, and we are suffering of these challenges on every day. So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh no, thank you. Good luck for your political mission here, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. So that was a fun interview to do.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. And I think that it covered a lot of topics that I'm interested in. One of the things that you pointed out to him, which I think you were correct about, was that Debian's it wasn't really auditing. I'm calling it auditing. But Debian's verification to making sure that packages are fully compliant with the licenses in question is a lot of important work, and I think it's good that Debian as a community is doing that work. But I think your comparison to enforcement is basically correct. But one of the things I think Debian's able to do is by putting things in non-free, that's actually a really strong message that they can send, because basically their response, if they can't come to an agreement with the developer to fix the package so that it's compliant, they have to move it to non-free, which is a really powerful action.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, you were saying before that it's sort of like a public shaming component.
Yeah, I think that's been a part of the enforcement strategy in what I would traditionally call standard GPL enforcement. There's often a component whereby we say something publicly about the violator that basically makes the public aware of the violation and hopefully gets people to send letters or otherwise put pressure. Well, the pressure of something moving to non-free, which means that most Debian users won't have it installed, installing it by default is basically impossible, and all sorts of other things that happen when something moves to non-free, I think that's actually a really powerful tool that Debian has. And when you talked with Zach about derivatives of Debian like Ubuntu, and that's possible as well. I actually, Karen, can you mute your back channel? I'm sorry to bring that up on the air, but I there's so much noise. I'm sorry. But yeah, so my point is basically that I think what Zach's doing is very valuable, and doing that is really important for enforcement. I think you were right to call it enforcement. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I wanted to call it enforcement too, because I think that enforcement sometimes has a bad name, and that people think that all enforcement activity is simply litigation and getting lawyers involved. But I think that traditionally hasn't been the case, and it isn't the case now, to my understanding, for matters that are, you know, addressed prior to, you know, the way things are handled before going to court. That going to court really is a last action. The contacting people nicely, trying to see if they can come in compliance in a friendly way is actually everyone's goal that I know of, who's actively conducting enforcement.
Yeah, that's the default position completely of everybody who does not, at least nonprofit enforcement. For-profit enforcement, things like MySQL AB used to do that I'm not a fan of, is different. But I think Zach may not realize, I'll talk to him next time I see him about it, that how close what Debian does is to regular enforcement. I mean, the only difference is that they're contacting a developer who's probably generally non-commercial developer, whereas most other enforcement is contacting commercial companies out of compliance. But the attitudes towards them are the same. They're all potential community members, and we want to treat equally community members who are doing work commercially and non-commercially. So I think it fits right in with what we've done in the past. And I hadn't realized that Debian was doing that work. And if they're using the power of threatening non-free as a way, I mean, that's a pretty big stick. I mean, it's as big a stick as the copyright restrictions themselves in a lot of ways, because a lot of packages would really hate to be moved to non-free because of a licensing issue.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a really interesting and slightly different approach that is unique to the set of tools that Debian has, as opposed to, you know, what copyright holders have.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing that that he said that I think was a very frank assessment that embarrassed me a little bit that it was true, but I think he was correct, that the Affero GPL was actually late in the sense that it was not copyleft available. And I've said publicly before that when RMS wanted to release GPL version 2.2, I was among a few people who talked him out of it. And he wanted to do that in 2002, and it was going to have an Affero-like clause in GPL v2.2. And I wish we'd released it then. I wish that had been default GPL in 2002, because I think it would have prevented a lot of the effectively proprietarization in the cloud. And I'm so glad to hear other people who are major leaders in more generalized free software projects like Debian talking about how the cloud application being non-source available is a serious issue for software freedom. There's another issue I want to talk about too related to that, but that issue stands on its own, I think, is an important one that we have to pay attention to. And I'm glad that the Debian project leader is paying attention to it.
Yeah, definitely. It was actually really great to be able to spend some time with him and get a sense of what he really does on behalf of the Debian project. And I know he said that one of his major tasks was to try to make it a little bit more transparent. And I think that's really great too. I think we can all learn from that. I say that as I have a report, you know, a sort of a public report message in draft that I've been trying to push forward for a week and just haven't had the time to do so. But I think for all of us that are sort of in charge of more nonprofit free software, you know, endeavors and organizations need to try to focus on that area of transparency.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I think Zach doesn't give Debian enough credit, that Debian has always been pretty much fully transparent. The question with Debian was always, how do you find out how the decisions were made? So for example, a classic transparency thing that's basically true, and it's publicly documented that it's true, that licensing decisions are made by the FTP masters in Debian. And that's publicly documented. If you search in the right places, you'll find the tickets where FTP masters are discussing the licensing stuff and making a decision about whether, as we were just talking about, a package is in free or non-free. Well, the funny thing is that everybody thinks that's a lack of transparency. It's not actually a lack of transparency. It was just a lack of easily accessible documentation to
it's
find
true.
That information out.
It's true. And actually, that particular point is a real source of confusion over the years. I remember many conversations I've had where folks believe that Debian Legal was the source of those decisions.
Yeah, Debian Legal has absolutely no authority whatsoever other than to post on its own mailing lists.
So did you say you had one other point you wanted to make?
Yeah, related to the Affero thing, Zach said this really quickly, but he pointed out that when a large company like Google has so many developers that any project they would rather not have as free software, they can rewrite from scratch relatively easily, that's a huge threat to software freedom, because the moment that company doesn't want to collaborate anymore, or that a set of companies doesn't want to collaborate anymore with a free software project, that is a huge moment when you can basically lose a free software community, because you can have The companies say, well, we're just going to rewrite this. We're not going to participate in the community. We're going to rewrite from scratch, and we'll make it proprietary if we want to, or we'll release it under a different license. We'll look at a copyleft program and say, ah, we wish that wasn't copyleft. Okay, let's just rewrite from scratch. And right. That's happening a lot now, and it's very frightening for free software because free software in general used to move much slower than it does now. And so the ability for proprietary companies to rewrite from scratch when they have lots and lots of money and lots of developers they can employ. I think we kind of got complacent on this issue because Microsoft was so bad at writing software. that we were like, oh, well, you know, we could just take our time, write our free software. And now companies that are much more tech savvy are willing to rewrite stuff from scratch when they don't feel like abiding by a free software license. And that's not a violation of a copyright law to rewrite something from scratch. So
yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, on the other hand, I think that we see a lot more quick popping up of new companies that that are relying on free software to get to market quickly. So I think, you know, by the same token, while, you know, there are efforts to rewrite a lot of stuff, at the same time, there's new stuff coming all the time that's based in free and open source software.
Okay, so I think there was another topic I want to talk about, but I think I could save it for a later podcast. I mean, it relates somewhat to this, but I think we have enough here for folks to enjoy.
I wanted to actually just make a clarification from the last episode, which was that interview with Adam Dingell. Michael Dexter actually wrote in to say that it sounded like we were suggesting that if you don't have tax-exempt status from the IRS during the period of your application, that you can't take donations in. And I didn't want people to think that that was the case. Really, what happens is that when you apply for a tax exemption, you have a period of time after you formed your nonprofit, you know, during which your application will be treated retroactively. I think it's 27 months after formation. So if you get your application in, once you get your tax exempt status, it's as if you were tax exempt from day one. So people who give you donations can take those deductions as tax, you know, as have the advantage on their taxes at the end of the year, only if you get the tax exempt status ultimately. And so what we were saying is that a lot of people aren't willing to give donations to organizations that are in that process where they're not sure whether they're tax exempt or not, because at the end of the year, maybe they won't be able to take a deduction. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, they don't know. And the worst part about all of this long delays by the IRS is that the fiscal period has come and gone by the time, by the time that the tax exemption comes. So most people who have donated to organizations that are waiting for their tax exemption, even if they do get tax, you know, their tax exemption, they won't see the benefit of it because they won't go back and look at the donations they made in the previous period. So I didn't want to make it sound like just because an organization was in the middle of waiting for their tax exemption that the donations made to them during that time wouldn't ultimately be deductible. But you basically have to count on the fact that the organization will get their tax exemption ultimately, which maybe they won't.
Yeah, and I guess people could file amended returns later, but that's so much work that
it's
a
total pain.
Yeah, I mean, you could go back to the fiscal year. So, for example, if you donated, say, in 2008 to an organization that gets its tax exempt status this year, you probably are still within the and we are not tax accountants and cannot give you tax advice, but you're probably still within the period of when you could file an amended return for 2008, which means you could add the deduction. But unless you gave tens of thousands of dollars to the nonprofit, if you go and amend return for like a $500 donation, even say if it's a relatively large individual donation, then $500 is pretty large for a single individual to give to a nonprofit. It's rare that that even happens, unfortunately. Even for that, you're talking about, oh, I'm going to get another $10 or $15 back from my tax in 2008 to spend the amount of work it would take to file an amended return to get $10 or $15 back. I doubt anybody would bother to do that. I think Michael's point, it has something to it, though, which is basically a lot of people who donate don't take a tax deduction. But for example, I haven't itemized my most of my life. I haven't itemized deductions in the United States. So for our non-US listeners, the way the tax benefit works for 501c3 status is that when you have it, you basically don't pay tax on the money you gave, but that's a part of this sheet on the tax form called the deduction sheet, which is called a Schedule A in the form 1040. And that you also get a standard deduction as an alternative. So if your itemized deductions, when you write them all down, don't add up to what the standard deduction is, you just take the standard deduction because it's going to be a higher tax deduction. Well, it's never the case for me because I don't own property. A property is a classic place where you get to itemize deductions and other such things. Because I don't have those things, I never itemize anyway. So if even when I give to charities, which I do every year and everyone should, it's that time of year when you should be writing checks to your favorite charities. And when I do that, I just never end up deducting it directly because it wouldn't get me up to the level of my standard deduction anyway. So I think Michael's fundamental point, which is that is the tax exemption that important and does it matter? I think that's sort of hidden in there. And I think that's true for a lot of donors. A lot of donors, they think at the time they give, oh, I'm going to take a tax deduction. But in the fact of the matter is they may or may not take that tax deduction later anyway. So it wouldn't have mattered if they gave to a charity that had 501c3 status or not. I think it's more of a warm fuzzies thing that people look at C3 and they say, oh, I want to give to a charity that's tax deductible. But that whether they do that deduction or not is actually a relatively open question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it probably depends on the donor, but also, you know, their grants. And I guess this is rehashing what we talked about with Adam and in the previous episode. So I guess no need to go there again. But I just wanted to make that clear that if an organization is in the process of getting its, you know, of applying for tax exemption, you still can donate to them and potentially take a deduction once they are granted tax exempt status.
Mm-hmm. And you could donate to, I mean, you could donate to anything you want. Pretty much any time you want.
you can give money to whoever you want to. It's just whether it's deductible or not.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And in the US, for example, people are used to giving to things like political campaigns and to lobbying organizations, neither of which are tax deductible in the US. So if you want to support those kinds of causes, they aren't tax deductible in any event.
Okay. So I think that wraps it up.
Yeah, so we'll have we'll record in the same room next time. So I have a weird feeling this might actually sound a little bit better because you actually have an audio engineer doing work on your end and I'm using the regular mic. So once Dan does his editing, this people might like listen to this and be like, why are they saying it sounds so bad when in fact it sounds just as good or if not better than the usual.
I don't know about that because I don't want Mike to be credited with this recording if it sounds not so great because I'm actually recording it myself on my laptop, not using him to you know, he's not recording it. So I don't want anyone to think that this, he does a much better job, I swear.
Oh, well, yeah, but I mean, I already made the point about the equipment we have. I mean, it's craftsman. That's the word I want. A fine craftsman also needs good tools, right?
Very true.
And we're using the equivalent of the knives, the audio knives and bearskins anyway. So I'm sure that the best has been done with the knives and bearskins that we had.
Cool. So, talk to you next time. Free as in Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. Free as in Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. Please send any feedback to oggcast@faif.us and subscribe to the RSS feed on faif.us.